Reading from the Brihad Bhagavad Kamrita, chapter, part 1, book 1, chapter 7, X98. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. One second. Okay. It's somehow or other we lose reception. Please send me an email. I'm hooked up pretty well, so I'll be able to know. But this is presentation mode, so only I can be heard, and I'm hoping that's better for reception. I don't always put it on because I don't have good computer reception. I'm afraid if it goes off, no one can tell me or something, or if I'm not clear. You can also send me an email. Reading from, okay. Tamissa punjadi yadeva kinchen madhyavano pamanikshyate tai sukumbanam tatpari labhyate mad yaparam tatva nuvarniyam. If they see a patch of darkness resembling my complexion, they embrace it and kiss it, mistaking it for me. What more can I describe? Commentary: when the devotees of Vrindavan, especially the young gopis, see a shadow or a dark place that reminds them of Krishna's spotless dark blue complexion, they think that Krishna is standing before them. What else they do besides trying to kiss and embrace the shadow, Krishna would rather not describe, because some of the hearers might be unqualified to understand, and others might be plunged into distress. Even if he were to return to his devotees in Vrindavan and grace them with his presence, he would be powerless to soothe and enliven them. And even in his absence, the Vrajavasis sometimes enjoy his presence on their own by picturing spiritual images of him within their mind. So Krishna feels he cannot do anything to change their situation and must remain an insolvent debtor, as he previously described. He should not be called ungrateful because the circumstances render him helpless. Om Ajnana Kimarangasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chaksurumalatam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Vairagya Yudhakti Rasam Payatnai Apayamamanaviksamandam Kapamburiya Paraduka Duki Sanatanastam Prabhumasrayami Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Shindu Bhaye Vacha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Nama Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Srivasa Devor Savinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ramo Hare Ramo Rama Rama Hare Hare. So greetings from New York City. I'm in for the weekend. I'm attending the seminar of Professor Bryant on the Yoga Sutras at Yoga Maya, which is such a wonderful and friendly place for me. And I have so many wonderful contacts there. Can't say enough how nice it is. And it's such a pleasure. It's from 1 to 4 and 6 to 9 to sit and just hear engaging Shastra to inspire spiritually. And Professor Bryant also speaks about bhakti. Actually, he was asked the question whether, you know, the concept of Ishvara in the Yoga Sutras is religious, you know. His point was it certainly is religious. It's referring specifically to what we call as God, and the verses give the characteristics of Ishvara, similar to the Bhagavad Gita and similar to the Bhagavatam. What is that? Chadmadhyasya yaton vayadhikritas svabhigya surat. The independent, omniscient person, but it's not sectarian. I like this point. He said Yoga Sutra is God light. Bhagavad Gita is God heavy. As it really presents, Krishna is God. Yeah, you must accept. Of course, Krishna is also a non-sectarian concept. When you say Krishna, you're referring to the absolute reality, but you're referring, and that's what the Brihad Bhagavatamrita is discussing, but you're discussing the absolute reality when the absolute reality is fully manifest in response to the most powerful and intimate love, which is how we see the revelation of personality is manifest in our own experience. We know people according to our relationship with them. And the more we trust them, the more they love us, the more we show and reveal who we are. I'm just going to see if I have any other points, and then I'll go on to the text here. Let's see. Most of my notes are in my book, which I didn't take here. He encouraged the students to sit, because sitting for 6 hours, sitting for 6 hours and listening, I thought it was really engaging. But he described it's like asana. You know, it's hard to stretch the body in different ways. When you do it, you feel great. This is intellectual asana. You sit and listen, but it has an effect. I'm just seeing if I find any other points. I like one point, I wrote it down. He said, when we are not happy, we think we haven't tinkered with prakriti or matter or not. That's the misconception of happiness. You know, we haven't controlled or moved matter enough. But, and then he described, it's very nice, and he said, all mystics have said that happiness is not to be found in this world. All spiritual traditions. Or mystical traditions. when it says not to be found in this world, it doesn't mean to renounce the world. But happiness is found in a change of consciousness, not a change in the construction of environment on an ultimate platform. Let me see if anything else. And what our mind is what we take in. So if we take in, we just see, if we're just taking in objects, and only rajas or passion comes into the consciousness, then that's what our mind becomes, and that's how our mind responds. And therefore, even if we're on a spiritual world, if that's how our mind is composed and we're not careful to reasonably filter what comes into the mind, and we're not careful, then we will just, even though we know it's not our objective, we will see the world simply as an object of our enjoyment. And we'll be constantly pulled externally. Anyway, I haven't done a justice at all in explaining. I wasn't planning on that. But many, many points became clear. And for me, it was very edifying, too, because it's just to revise something that you studied and to make it clearer. I'm pretty confident now I could really sum up the Yoga Sutras. And I may even do it on one of my sanghas. I could probably do it in one class. Let's go over the key verses. But let's get back to the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. And we're in the section where Krishna is upset with Satyabhama because Satyabhama did not greet him when he came back from the palace from Nava Vrindavan. And the reason Krishna is so upset is because Satyabhama, unlike the other queen, is upset by the fact that she's upset with what she saw in Nava Vrindavan, and that's Krishna's full expression of love for the gopis. And I think most of you are following this enough, I don't have to repeat what happened, at least that's my impression. So she was upset, some kind of envy. And while the other queens saw that in Krishna's intense reciprocation with the gopis, unrestricted by the formalities of being the queen and wife, the queen to the king, the wife of the king, unrestricted by the social formality, the etiquette of dealing with pati or superior, that something of Krishna was covered or checked to satisfy that tinge of reverential responsibility in that relationship. And therefore the full glory of Krishna was not manifest. So when they saw the full glory of their husband that manifests in this relationship with the gopis, they actually became very happy, because that was their mood of devotion towards Krishna. So now, this is probably one of the quickest introductions that I had. So now Krishna is telling Satyabhama, and we're actually finishing that section, that he's telling her, this is why the gopis are so dear to me. And he gives this description of their incredible devotion. And he answers the question, which actually is a theological concern that has to be reconciled with the devotees of Krishna, if why he loved the gopis so much, he didn't return. And this is answered in a description of their love and the description of the Parama Mahatva, the supreme greatness of their feeling of love that's so intense that it manifests in this super excellent Varaha Bhav, this intense separation. That is so deep that Krishna even fears going back to relieve it. Because just like a person who's sick gradually has to carefully take food, regain his appetite, and if in the desire to nourish that person, you give too quickly or too much, the person's health can become even worse. So the sensitivity and intensity of their love, and therefore their incredible feelings of separation, make their heart so laden with emotion and so sensitive to love that the slightest thought in that condition, even as they're awakening and gradually beginning to enjoy the beauty of Krishna, coming out of that volcanic expression of devotion, that's Sanatana Goswami is just trying to give us a frame of reference. What would the highest love look like? If you would have to write a novel or a story, and you would have to describe the highest love. Now, philosophically, Krishna is enjoying love. Gaudiya Vaishnava perception. That is the Ladini Shakti. That is the pleasure potency. The essence of the pleasure potency is Krishna Prema. Krishna Prema heightened to the highest degree is Mahabhava. So if you had just a novel and any reader to write a story of the highest love, what would it look like? And could it be greater than what's described here in terms of Varaha Bhav? The feelings that are felt and are have continued to grow year after year in Krishna's absence. So Sanatana Goswami is trying to explain it to us, trying to make us have some frame of reference that is so deep that Krishna can't even go back. You just have to stay with them a long time, and inevitably they will worry that any moment he may leave. And then he describes the existential nature of this separation, that it must be part, constitutionally, of any description of the Supreme Love. To such an extent, and it's a beautiful reference that he gives, when the whole tenth canto finishes, and Krishna's in Dwarka, and there's a description of what the queens are feeling, that it's understood that the reference is that even when they are speaking about separation from Krishna, they are actually with him. And then another very, very beautiful thing describing this, and this is the answer to Narada Muni's quality. Who's the recipient of the highest mercy? Those whose love has intensified to the degree that deep separation to the extent that Varaha Bhava is manifest in the heart. Just as I was explaining Prabhupada's disappearance, when it's very wonderful at Govardhan Hill, there's some very wonderful God brothers there, and it's a place where everybody can express their heart to the fullest. We have 3-4 hours, everybody can speak 10 minutes, 5 minutes, 20 minutes. Some God sisters there. And to see that after after 34 years of Prabhupada's disappearance, they still dread the day of his appearance day because of the agony of the feelings of separation they're feeling. Isn't that love? And in a strange way, isn't that happiness? Because of that love. So Krishna is explaining this. How they're partaking in these ecstasies. And then explains in the same way that on some transcendental level, because as separation is constitutional, union is constitutional. So the same soul who is the highest recipient of the flow of Krishna's mercy, which is the flow of prema bhakti, has these two embankments simultaneously. The embankment of separation, the embankment of union, so the river of prema just flows powerfully through their hearts. And that's the conception of happiness, that there's an energy of the divine that causes happiness for the divine and for those who love the divine. And it's an energy that flows from the divine through one's heart and returns to the divine. That flow is pleasure. If you can look at it as a juice, a rasa, and what flow, just like when intense lust flows from the heart, it burns. It's not satisfying. There's an energy. But when this selflessness and prema flows from the heart, and this is the last verse that Krishna basically explains it. He'll explain it more. And if they see a patch of darkness resembling my complexion, they embracing, even I'm not there, they're so insane. They're so on the platform of Bob. They're so on the platform of fame that they're embracing and kissing a patch of darkness because I am also dark. So Sanatana Goswami is communicating to us the churning of affection to the highest degree, which is described why prema cannot be contained within the material body. And one, before he gets prema, he has to achieve bhava. And when he achieves bhava, which is prema ankur, which is the seed of prema, he takes birth where Krishna's having his pastimes. Just back to Professor Bryant's class to give it a little justice. You know, he just made it clear to the people, very, very clear, that when the object of your love is Ishvara, yoga, it means Atma. You're thinking of the self. Bhakti, it means your mind is filled with Ishvara. To describe the main way it is that Ishvara appears in sound, and through the sound vibration is carried directly into your heart. And the mind becomes filled with love for Ishvara, because the object of your meditation is so beautiful. And it has the facility of reciprocating and removing the material energy which is his energy. This energy, Daiva Esha Gunamayi, these gunas, Mama Mayi, they're mine. And they only follow your desire. So wouldn't the easiest way to become liberated from the gunas is to give up the desire that caused the gunas? That's bhakti. And the desire is not to love Krishna, not to serve God. And when you serve God, you're reversing the consciousness that, so basically speaking, they're God's gunas. So what better way to become liberated than to serve God and have him remove the gunas? And he was just making it. You have your choice. He's talking to the yogis. You can take the easy path or the more difficult path. He said, if you're talking about the Yoga Sutras, and one thing about Professor Bryant that's really appreciative is he's objective. He just presents what's there, which is appreciated. He just says, which do you want? What path do you want? But as we know, it's not so easy to surrender to Krishna, because you're dealing with the ego. Therefore, the application is simple, or the process is simple, the application is difficult. Anyone can surrender to God, but You have to give up your ego. Namaha. Obeisances mean namaha. Maha, ego, without ego. You give up the conception that the world is yours for your enjoyment. What a consciousness. Do we like to be with those type of people? That the world is theirs for their enjoyment? We don't mind being in the world of a person who is in the world of God. And therefore just bringing us in to the service of the universal interest. Therefore it's dangerous, because if the guru is not in that consciousness, then you go into his world and it, or her world, and that means exploitation. We enter into that world, the service. So this is bhakti. And that world of bhakti is described to be the Bhagavad-gita, to the highest degree. And now this prema, this bhakti, this energy, it flows through the heart. And when the river of that energy flows to the highest degree, it's an overwhelming emotional experience. And that you want it so badly, the object of your love, is that even when he's not there, you may see him. Okay, now we'll go on to a few more verses. Therefore, my staying with them would be equal to my absence. Realizing this, I have returned there. Now hear the real reason I married them. Now, his reason for marrying them has to be with the gopis. One, they're expansions of the gopis on an ontological platform. But on the platform of the lila, one second. Seen to them, they will be torn by the ecstasies of separation, and he will suffer the frustration of being unable to help them. Such is the apparent misery of Krishna as devotees. But there is another level of this transcendental reality unseen to ordinary eyes. Krishna lives internally in Vrindavan, and his invisible apricot manifestation endlessly continuing to bestow the enjoyment of his pastimes. In some confidential pastimes, he returns to Vrindavan from Gorkha in his apricot form. Thus, at the same time that the devotees of Vrindavan suffer separation from Krishna's prakat manifestation, they continue to enjoy forever the manifestation of which his pastimes are apricot. So it's constitutional. I should say it's essential. It's constitutional. Just the
appreciate what's being described here. The concept, the ideal. Some subtle hints have already been spoken by Krishna. So there's subtle hints already that Krishna's actually had come back to Vrindavan. So this is also solving this question. How? And he was challenged. He was challenged in Dwarka by Rohini and by others. How can you be so cruel that you let them suffer to this degree? So in text 93, I can never fully repay these devotees. I'm actually indebted to them. He has to come back. He cannot not come back. And just by seeing me, they become so dazed and bewildered by ecstasies from deep within. So he has to come back to also give them this sense of ecstasy. That's 95 and 96. Whatever measures I take for their happiness will only double their grief. Elsewhere, the evidence for Krishna's secretly returning to Mathura Mandala is more concise. This is nice. It's Shastra. It's scholarship. Going through the Bhagavatam. These are the hints. Now this is more direct. In Srimad Bhagavatam 111.9, the citizens of Dwarka mention Krishna's trip to Hastinapur and Mathura Mandala. And the ladies, that's in 111.9, and the ladies of Hastinapur, referring to Krishna's perpetual presence in Mathura, speak in the present tense. So when the ladies of Hastinapur, because Krishna is leaving Hastinapur in the 26th chapter of the 10th canto, he's leaving Hastinapur. But they talk of him in the present tense of being in Vrindavan. Aho alam shlagyatamam yadokulam, aho alam punyatamam madoranam, vinesha pumsam shabhapriyastriya, Oh, how supremely glorified is the dynasty of King Yadu, and how virtuous is the land of Mathura, where the supreme leader of all living beings, the husband of the goddess of fortune, is making the land by his birth, marking the land by his birth and activities. It's in present tense. And then he goes to women of Mathura, how they talk about Krishna being present still in Vrindavan. Vinya Pata Vajibhavo Yarayam Nilanga Udaparana Purusho Vanachitta Maya Tapalayam Sahapala Kwameyam Sthavenu Vikri Deyanchiti Vritta. How pious are the tracts of land in Vraja, for there the primeval personality of Godhead, disguising himself with human traits, wanders about, enticing his many pastimes, adorned with wonderful variegated forest garlands, variegated, many garlands, the most beautiful, exquisite, fragrant, colorful garlands offered for his pleasure and embodying the love of the residents of Vrindavan. His feet worshipped by Lord Shiva and Goddess Rama, he vibrates his flute as he tends the cows in the company of Balaram. He's expressing through the flute the deep emotion and affection he has for the residents of Vrindavan is constantly being announced. And that's the Bhagavatam 10.44.13. In the Uttarakhanda of Padma Purana, Lord Shiva relates to his wife an even more explicit account of Krishna's returning to Vraja and remaining there permanently. And in the second part of his Brihad Bhagavatamrita, the glories of Golok, the conclusion will demonstrate that Lord Krishna always resides in Gokul. Nevertheless, Krishna has chosen not to divulge to Satyabhama and his queens that he returned to Gokula. Hearing about this would distress them, and he cannot tolerate seeing his devotees distressed. So he's saying how I have not returned. But the commentary he's just saying that because he doesn't want to disturb her. But he actually has returned. Vishamabhave purvame vatsato matarapure vivaha karane kachit ichapya sinnamanini. Oh, dear proud lady, when living in Mathura Puri, without the gopis, I at first had no desire to marry. Commentary, Krishna is now less hesitant to mention to his queens the gopis of Vraja, since the queens have already been drawn to thinking about them. This verse, therefore, he dares to use the feminine construction to some of Ave, the absence of those women. But he still refrains from mentioning the names of Radhika and the other gopi. It's very beautiful because what you're hearing is they have this highest special ecstasy of Rahava. And you see the extent that Krishna loves them. But of course, it's not that he doesn't love the queen. Because the queens are expansions of the gopi. But it's just another flavor of that prema. Because the concept of prema or rasa is that it's intense. But it's enjoyed in a variety of ways. So just look at the description of pleasure and love as a ontological, existential reality. How it's explained, how intense it is. But it doesn't negate that it's enjoyed in intensity and it's enjoyed in variety. So one variety of that love is a little formality, social obligation in terms of the queen. But it's an intense love because they're always in separation from Krishna, even if he's with them. And then you have the Rukmini, who has a variety of pure love, but it's submissive. And then you have Satyabhama. It's contrary. In that regard, just because some people always, I usually hear at the beginning, like, you know, hear through my eyes what's going on in the world of sharing Krishna consciousness. I'm going to be going back after the class, driving Professor Bryant back to Princeton, and I'll be teaching his classes on Tuesday. And I almost feel like it's almost the perfection of my desire of doing what I do, because he has a 3-hour seminar on Bhakti Rasa Mita Sindhu, which he's teaching with a group of 15 students, and he's asking me to, in those 3 hours, cover the Eastern Division. It's so pleasurable for me that I can use the years of study in that way. It's so wonderful. I can present in a scholarly way what is the structure of Nectar of Devotion, a summary of what all the divisions are, then a summary of what all the waves are, then a summary of the Eastern Division, which is the particular division I'm discussing, and describe a summary of the key points in that text. And then in the afternoon, in his Hinduism class, which has like 250 students or something, he wants me to debunk Shankaracharya. So I'm very, very happy to do that. I've had discussions with Mahamudi this week, you know, to really understand what Shankaracharya's philosophy is, to what degree. But the concept, basically the thing is the Upanishads describes Ishvara, personal God. And therefore there appears to be a duality. But at the same time, the Upanishad is also describing this oneness. So Shankaracharya's solution to that is that it must be illusion. He somehow feels a necessity in the name of oneness to obliterate distinction, where oneness does not have to obliterate distinction, because there can be harmony, which is oneness, which is a more reasonable conception of looking at absolute reality. Even practically, if we look at our body, everything's our body. But the fact that the foot is not the nose, or the mouth is not the eyes, doesn't negate the oneness of the body. So the distinctions that exist in the world do not negate that it's all advayam gyan, it's all consciousness of the same thing. Anyway, but there's also, we went over some of the arguments. It's interesting. One argument is that he's trying to explain Shastra, but he explains all differentiality as illusion. So then how do you explain in Shastra that there's that there's God, and he's, but how do you, Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's explaining to Arjuna? And how do you explain ignorance? Who is the possessor of ignorance? If there's ignorance, and Shankaracharya is explaining ignorance, who is the possessor of ignorance? A wonderful discussion with Mahamuni. You know, this is his expertise. Especially, he's really delved deeply into his own field of study and studying the Nayakas, who are theistic. So what is the basis? What holds ignorance? If you say ignorance, it has to be something that holds ignorance. If you say the jivas are in ignorance, but no, the jivas have no substance. Not, if something holds something, it has to have substance. According to Shankaracharya, the jivas are a product of illusion. So then you only have to ascribe it to Brahman. But then you have to explain, and then there's duality. And then there's Brahman and ignorance. Sure, Mahamuni can explain it even clearer, but... And then the whole Shastra, it becomes a product of ignorance. And Shankaracharya has to admit that. So then why is he commentating on Shastra? His problems. And then there's more common things, just that you deny love. You have to embrace the consequences of your position. If you say that everything is one and all distinction is illusion, then you have to also say that love does not exist. Do people who embrace undifferentiated oneness really want to negate that love exists? The impersonalist, yes, would embrace it. That's what they, I'm not the, you know, Mayavad, they would embrace it. But the people today who somehow have that conception, do they really embrace that the feelings of selflessness and devotion are illusion? Anyway, just some fun, so I'm going to do that. And on Thursday, Adanya is arranged at the Institute, what is it, of the Integral Yoga Institute of Princeton, which is in Princeton, that I'm going to give my seminar on the yoga of forgiveness. And then next week on April 10th, at I'm wondering if I have to pay myself for the commercials here. On April 10th, on April 10th, then I'll give a seminar on Yoga Maya called Seer in the Scene, The Journey to Selflessness, how the basis of ego and suffering is the wrong conception, which is based on desire, as seeing ourselves as the enjoyer and controller. And the basis of liberation is to negate that consciousness by seeing ourselves, it's called the seeing, seeing ourselves as the object for the love of God. Okay, anyway, simple. Anyone like to say hello or ask a question?
Maharaj?
Yeah, Mooney. Great, thank you.
Thanks for a great class today, and your kind words. I had two questions about the class, if that's okay?
Yeah.
One is
sure.
One's theoretical, the other is kind of more practical.
Yeah.
The theoretical one is that you had mentioned, I guess there's this kind of esoteric understanding that to fully develop your spiritual identity, you need to take birth with a body that's not made of matter or something like that, because a body made of matter couldn't handle prema.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, I mean, I have the impression that, you know, with the holy name or with the deities, the difference between matter and spirit really is superficial. And Krishna has the capacity to do whatever he wants with these things that are supposedly matter. And I mean, we also have like those verses that, you know, Sri Jiva Goswami quotes that when you undergo diksha.
Come in. I will. I'm giving my class, but just ahead. If you're out, I'll be finished in a few minutes. Okay. You're out. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
So you're there now?
So I got it.
You know, Jiva Goswami quotes those verses, or the verse that says, when you undergo diksha, your body basically becomes spiritual.
Right.
And so I don't, it doesn't make sense. Why couldn't, I
okay.
mean.
Okay, let me say one thing. Let me explain the concept of, you know, the bhava and the prema. Then I'd have to see if I actually have a reference. I just heard it from someone. I accepted it because I accepted their authority and, you know, maybe didn't think about it. That's also possible, you know, because I heard so much in Vrindavan. So it's good to see if there's actually pramana. But let me just see if I can explain. I don't have pramana right now. You know what I'm saying? I don't have a reference, just that I've heard it. So it's always good to check. It's an opulence that I lived in Vrindavan, you know, and got to hear from so many different people in so many different circumstances. But I guess the challenge is, you know, sometimes when you hear, maybe, you know, you should be a little mindful to get a reference, but we know that that's a fact.
That what's
you know,
a fact?
From the Bible,
what?
That
what's a fact?
That we know that it's a fact that people, you know, I'm explaining, obviously I'm not going to say, you know, this is a fact. You got to drop the Nayaka, you know, hat there. I'm going to explain. We know in the Bhagavatam that to perfect one's bhakti, one takes birth in Krishna's pastimes, right? And, it, you know, it gives the example that there's still some connection with their husbands, you know what I'm saying? You know, there's different types of gopis, right? And some of the gopis, when the flute is heard, they go directly to Krishna. And some of them, they have to experience this separation, and it burns off whatever obstacle is. So there's some idea of some progression that you have bhava, and there's a training or something to go to train. So now, if the reason is that that's a fact of whether it can't be contained in the body, right, or it's just a natural progression of further training, I'd have to think about it. And I think the question that you brought up right now is in terms of the body, if it can have, even becoming spiritualized, if it has some limits, you know, and if there is I'd have to research that further. You want to say anything else?
No, that's okay. That makes sense.
I really have to penetrate. I'm still of the opinion. I haven't found the pramana, and I would like to research it, and if I remember, bring it in the class, what the philosophical, you know, what the limits of the body are. Because sometimes, you know, you have the term Jivan Mukta, right?
Uh-huh.
Right? And what does a Jivan Mukta mean? You know? You know, he's liberated even in this body. Right?
Uh-huh.
But, it, you know, there's something higher than that too. Right? Than a Jivan Mukta. You know? There's, and also in terms of perfection, there's Sarup City and there's Vastu City. Sarup City means that you mentally conceive the body, right? And Vastu City means, you know, it actually becomes in substance. So there may be some shades of kind of perfection within the theology that allow the statements that when you get initiated, you know, Krishna accepts you fully and you become spiritual, you know. And if there, you know, and if that transformation is equal to what's called Vastu City, where, you know, there's a different substance, when it says, you know, the body becomes spiritual, does the body become chit, or is it used in a functional way? And maybe there's a difference with the conception of the spiritual body. I mean, these are all things to investigate. Okay, what's your other comment or question?
Well, I'm not sure. I kind of have
this.
Feeling
about what?
Well, the question, it's a question about, you had mentioned that that people, you know, you were talking about how, what kind of people would you like to be around, and it was a way of reflecting on the transformation from selfishness to being other-centered. And you had said right. that who would you rather be around? People who are kind of like, I don't know if you said religious or God conscious, I forget exactly, but you know, there's a way in which my first thought was, well, you know, if I look through the inventory of all the people I know who say they're God conscious, I don't know. I know a lot of nice people that aren't officially religious who are easier to be around.
Well, the point that I made wasn't about necessarily, I mean, I'd like to extend it to God consciousness,
yeah.
you know, but the point I was making was not that. It was on a more basic, fundamental platform. What I was saying is, who would you like to be around more, right? And there's a concept here, too, of substance and allegiance. You know, I mean, allegiance means that your faith is that anyone who's connected with the right conception is the highest person, regardless of what they do, you know? So I don't want to say, you know, I wouldn't want to ever define just religious like that. They have a badge, they're, you know, Rodians or Iskan or whatever, or Catholic or whatever your badge is, and that makes you good whether or not you actually access the tradition, even though you have more faith in it. But I was just trying, I think you misread this one, because what I was saying is the concept of materialist is he's self-centered, and he looks at everything as an object of his consciousness. And therefore, militantly, things are their world. And when you enter in that world, then you're exploited. There's nothing about your desires or needs,
yeah.
you know. And it's a whole extension of things. So the meditation I'd like to give people of is, you know, how unpleasant it is, you know, to be with someone. And I think the point I made, you know, if it's guru, right, it's not coming into a world that at least that person shouldn't have the concept that, you know, my disciple is in my world, right, for my desires, but the guru should be in Krishna's world. He should be in his guru's world. So when you're coming into that person's world, you're coming into Krishna's world, you know. Not that you're simply, you know, seen as an object for that person's whims and desires, you know. He's carrying the universal interest. And I like to look at theism in its purest extent is coming in contact with the universal interest. Now, there are people, and we know, there are people that are not, you know, so theistic, that are kind of altruistic and pleasant.
You're absolutely right, Marjan. You know, but here's, I mean, there's a superficial way to see what the kind of problem is or whatever, but I think here's what a friend of mine said once about his experience sometimes with devotees. He said, when they see you, they see how can you fulfill their service. And how can you help them with their service? And I think you could say, hey, they're God conscious. They want to serve God. And they're thinking, how can I help them serve God? So I guess the idea is, it's not just a matter of allegiance, but I don't know. I mean, do you see what I'm saying? I'm not saying that's even wrong, that conception. But I'm asking you, do you see how that could be, create a certain kind of tension? Or do you think it would?
I can see how it could create a certain type of tension. But let's look at it again, not in terms of the allegiance, but of the substance. If
okay.
someone is actually pure, right?
Mm-hmm.
If someone is actually pure, then they're looking at the person in terms of their benefits or needs.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And there may be some tension, too. You know, and the person should also be sensitive that not everybody accepts what they do, you know. But I do actually see the danger of carrying that consciousness, even if your objective is preaching, you know, and even if your objective is preaching, because it seems to morph, it seems to so easily morph into an egotistical thing.
And I'm just thinking of people who I really, you know, admire and are really advanced spiritually and actually become pure-hearted, you know, who are preachers, you know, how they would actually respond to other people. They would really be looking at their needs, and it would start with their common needs, consideration. You know, are you cold? Do you need a chair? Do you, you know? And then they would have to assess, right? They would have to assess, you know, does this person have the samskar, nature, or desire, right, to benefit what I have, I can give them, you know? So it would really be thinking of the person's needs at different levels. So, you know, but I can see that, you know, the danger is this danger with anything, you know. I mean, obviously, a devotee means he looks at the world with God, and he wants people to be in God's world for their benefit, you know. But I know the kind of consciousness that you have, that your friend has perceived, and I perceive that there's something else in that type of consciousness besides pure God consciousness, that's actually disturbing.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And when I think about my own life, when I was in the temple, there's ways in which I would just say, okay, we can plug you into the needs of the temple. But it's not complete God consciousness. It's just it's narrow-minded sometimes. I mean, not to say that's never the right attitude. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It also reminds me, you know, my experience with Ravindra Sarup Prabhu, who was the temple president, I was always so impressed that when people would want to, like, leave or something, you know, the temple president has to think, like, who's going to cook the offering, who's going to do this?
Yeah.
But I was always impressed that he'd always think about the individual's needs first, and then, hey, if we have to scramble, we'll scramble. You know,
right.
It just shows me this kind of... Sorry.
Right. I would see that, and it would suffer. but I would see that he was extraordinarily detached in that way, you know, of possessing men. I've seen that, right? And, you know, people go other things. Anyway, thank Mooney. It's good. I know you're busy. You were sick, and then you moved there. So it's good to have you on again. This is kind of, it's intellectual asana. You know? It makes your mind strong. It's great. Thank you. Anybody
thank
else
you.
Like to say hello? Anybody else like to say hello?
Does that mean I have to email you my questions?
Gail, I think Mahamuni exhausted me.
Okay, then I'll do
it's
that.
Like, okay, go ahead. Okay, anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, please accept my humble obeisances.
Okay, Amiya, thank you. Okay, great. Amiya, just
yes.
One other thing, I just tell you while I got you on the phone. Some people very close to me are coming from Christchurch in August.
Yes.
A very nice couple, and they're coming to serve me, but they're coming to New York first from the 8th to the 12th, so
you
I'll discuss
them
with you later. Okay. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, it's Chris in Pennsylvania.
Chris, I got your letter. I'm still working out the dates. Okay, thanks.
Okay, perfect.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj, Jaini Thai here.
Jaini Thai. Okay.
I did get your message yesterday. I'm still sort of working on that project. I apologize if it takes so long.
Okay. Maybe we can just temporarily discuss again.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks for the nice class.
Later. Okay. Anybody else like to say hello?
Thank you so much.
Here, Govardhan, and who else is there?
Ananda Dulal, Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Ananda Dulal, Hare Krishna. Great. Good. So many nice people. Anybody else like to say hello?
Haribo Maharaj.
Shastra?
Hi.
Okay. Great. Anybody else?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Henry, wow. Okay. One more person. Okay, Vanshikalpa to the second.